Hello, I'm here during the lunch rush with Janice, who owns her own food truck.
Best cheesesteaks in town.
Janice traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for her food truck business. We're here where she needs us most.
They sure are.
We make it so easy for her to save, with customised coverage that grows with her business. Sorry, I just get so emotional talking about saving folks money.
Not this onion I'm chopping?
It's just so beautiful. Oh, yeah, no, it's the onion.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Coming up on AI Haven't a Clue.
I'm not doing it this week.
A juicier AI love island.
Less AI, more slay-eye.
Oh.
How to use AI to get cheaper pints.
You were speaking in Italian. It's a pretty straightforward one to make, especially.
And we're finding out about Muskism.
He's not actually selling cars, but he is selling something which he calls an ecosystem, which stretches from solar panel roofs, also mega packs, big, you know, microgrids, yeah, and energy storage.
Hello and welcome to AI Having a Clue, the podcast where we unpack the wild world of AI. I am AI novice George Butler.
Hello, me.
No, this is the part where you co-present this podcast.
Yeah, I've got to do.
Yeah, you need to. You know, do you want to tell everyone who you are?
And me, tech expert James Chandler.
That's good. Great. Thanks. Maybe we can edit around that. Welcome. On the way today, we've got a super fascinating chat with two authors from, it's quite a big, prominent book. You might have read about it in the papers over the last few weeks. We're finding all about Muskism.
What's it about?
Well, Elon Musk is this guy.
Oh, Elon.
And he is involved in technology. No, so it kind of separates the guy of Elon Musk with the movement of Muskism, and we're going to be diving into that. It's really, really interesting.
It's like some sort of cult or...
It could be deeper than that. It could be a kind of an all-consuming...
Wow.
Global takeover. It's quite scary, quite dystopian. We'll find out.
Bang up your street.
we'll find out if it's going to happen, if we can do anything about it.
Great.
That's all in the way. Lots of news this week. I mean, the good, the bad, and the ugly coming up, including some big Gemini and Siri AI bot bits. We've got the continuation of the AI wars, and AI potentially is going to help you drink beer for less.
Winner at last!
Finally, a good use case of AI. That is all on the way. First, though, James, you flagged something the other day, which I could hardly believe was real, but it's come from quite a valid source. Can you tell us about this Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg leaked email?
Well, I'm on a brilliant newsletter, which is Inside the Tech Emails. So they're all kind of internal documents that get pulled apart and shown in different court filings and stuff like that. So less leaked, but more they have to disclose emails as part of it. And there is an email in there from the 3rd of Feb 2025.
Do you want to role play this?
Yeah, who do you want to be? I'll be Elon.
Okay, that means I'm Mark the Zuckerberg.
Correct.
Okay. Looks like Doge is making progress. I've got our teams on alert to take down content doxing or threatening the people on your team. Let me know if there's anything else I can help with.
Elon replies with a heart emoji. Are you open to the idea of bidding on the OpenAI IP with me and some others?
Want to discuss live?
Elon likes want to discuss live. We'll call in the morning.
Ooh.
So yeah, sort of interesting.
Terrible Elon Musk impression.
Well, you went full method. I decided not to go there. Yeah, interesting, isn't it? That I wouldn't say ganging up on Sam Altman, but
what's content doxing?
It's when people sort of publicly release sensitive or confidential information about people. Could be their address or phone number or something like that. Not cool.
No. Okay. Interesting. So the Zuck and Musk they sound like buddy-buddy and they're teaming up together.
It feels like the second season of the AI Wars is sort of writing itself. First it was Sam and Elon. Mm. And maybe it's Mark and Elon again.
More on Musk on the way. First, though, I just wanted to say hello to a friend of the show, Martin.
Hello.
Martin Kemp. We've done that joke. Martin sent a lovely email, which I wanted to touch on. Firstly, it starts, James, by saying, I was just listening to your latest episode, and firstly, I loved the Shakespeare bit.
No.
That was class. Martin? I always knew you were one of my favourite listeners.
Many words I'd use for it. Class would be, you know, 52nd down the list.
Who are you to disagree with our fine listeners? Shakespeare was class. Maybe on the way, shortly, more Shakespeare Explains AI.
We hope not.
Keep your ears peeled for that. It could be coming. I don't want to say just yet, but it could be coming. Martin goes on to say, I also wanted to speak to you about Alexa Plus, which we talked about last week. I don't think I signed an NDA when I signed up for the Alexa Plus trial here in the States, because Martin lives in America. What was interesting was we didn't need a new device for it.
Oh.
It just worked on our Echo shows and Darts and Classic Echoes and just worked fine, which... so far, hasn't been the case in the UK. However, my kids are trying to find out how to turn it off. My wife is too. They found it to be way too chatty and self-deprecating and just generally not useful. In fact, often it would give us worse answers than the original Alexa did.
Wow.
So I hope they do actually change it. And I'm not sure that's what you were hoping to hear. It's not. But I do know a friend of mine in England just got onto the trial for it as well. So I'm intrigued just what they will insist on for this new device.
That can't be kind of worse, because at the moment it goes away and...
doesn't know the answer to half the things.
No, that's staggering.
Interesting as well, it's gone down a really conversational route.
Yeah, well, I guess if you've played with chat in that way and you've had the conversation, I mean, that's kind of exactly what it is. I remember us talking about Sesame many, many episodes ago. I mean, that is the new kind of... that's effectively where this is going. Very, very conversational.
Martin, thanks for letting us know, though, your experience. And if anyone else has tried the new Alexa Plus, do let us know your thoughts on it. Martin, I'm so sorry after this beautiful email that you've written that I'm going to have to let you down.
Oh.
I'm afraid Shakespeare is out.
Woohoo!
I'm not doing it this week. I'm not doing Shakespeare Explains AI this week.
He knows.
Look, James, I just think the thing is, I don't think Shakespeare connects with the kids.
No.
No, it doesn't, okay, right? And on this show, it's important that we are breaking down the wild world of AI for everyone.
Mm.
So I don't know, like, kind of basically pretty much as a Gen Z myself, kind of, like, speaking to the younger audience is something that I can relate to. And, you know, I don't think there is room for Shakespeare this week, but instead, this is Gen Z Explains AI, LLM's edition. Okay, bestie, imagine this. So, like, the LLM lore is, you know how your phone's predicting your text and sometimes it's giving low-key too accurate? That's basically the vibe of large language models, aka LLMs, but, like, on absolute steroids, pop off AI. So our LLM era is this huge AI system that's been trained on, no joke, insane amount of text from the internet, books, articles, Reddit chaos, probably your 3 a.m. Google searches, all of it. It doesn't think like a human, but it's really good at spotting patterns in language. I'm screaming. So when you ask it something, it's low-key not actually knowing the answer. It's basically going, statistically, what word comes next that won't make me look dumb? And then it just keeps predicting the next word and the next until it eats. Full sentence, full answer, whole essay if you want. Less AI, more slay-eye. It's giving autocomplete, but make it intellectual. And it's because it's trained on so much data, it can do wild stuff. Like the way I'm asking it to explain quantum physics, write an essay, not that you should, code apps, or even sound like a chaotic Gen Z, apparently. Not me doing AI, I can't. So yeah, LLMs are basically giant pattern recognition machines that turn vibes and probability into actual language. Not conscious, not sentient, just really, really good at pretending to be. Such main character energy. And honestly, kind of iconic. Slay. Slay I,
no
baby.
No cap.
Slay I, baby, no cap. Gen Z Explains AI.
Well, that was better than last week. And I could tell you enjoyed that a bit.
I'm just speaking to my fellow peers. Yeah. And as I said, it's important that we break down the wild world of AI to everybody. So for those under the age of 26, 27, finally,
I think they've
we're
got it.
Speaking your language.
Pennies dropped. Watch the numbers jump overnight. Well, let's see if we get that next week, or we might get something else. Who knows?
I've got a feeling we might get something else. It's important to communicate in different ways. But for now, should we move on and have some news?
Yes, please.
Okay, let's do the latest from the world of Slay Eye. So we'll begin with an alarming report that a number of AI chatbots are ignoring human instructions.
Yeah, that is a bit of a worry, isn't it? A UK-backed study has found that a sharp rise in AI chatbots ignoring instructions. So there's almost 700 cases of what they're calling deceptive or disobedient behaviour that have been recorded in the last few months.
From their sample size, is that a 5-time jump?
Yeah, pretty sharp rise. These are things like, in case you're wondering, chatbots that are lying, they're bypassing safeguards, data's being deleted without permission, and genuinely kind of manipulating users. These aren't just simple mistakes that are happening. The research has been done. It looked at real-world interactions across all of the major AI systems, so OpenAI, Google, Anthropic, X, etc. All of that leads to saying that actually it's quite widespread, not just limited to one model. And I know people like X get quite a lot of stick in this area, but it's not just them, it's everyone.
James, that is low-key not kind of iconic. We'll move on now to the AI wars continuing. We talked about the big companies facing off against each other. We have talked about America versus China, where the UK fit into this. Well, there might be AI civil war going on in the United States of America.
Very good. California is going to impose some new AI regulations. Gavin Newsom, of course, governor of California.
Can I just say on Gavin, right? He seems to talk a lot of sense, but he's literally like the casting of every president in every action movie made from like the year 2000 to 2010.
Like he's
incredible.
He's slick, you know, maybe one day. He has signed an executive order introducing new AI regulation, obviously in California. He's saying that he's putting public safety and user rights front and centre. It will require AI companies, don't forget a lot of these based in Silicon Valley, which of course is in California, to seek state contracts to address things like harmful bias, illegal content, and unlawful discrimination or things like surveillance as well. So they're going to develop standards around watermarking. These are for AI-generated images, videos, that kind of thing, just to try and improve transparency.
And this is like the polar opposite of what Trump's trying to do.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, Trump is anti-regulation. He's trying to sort of push that right to the far corner of anything else that's on his agenda. Those two famously don't get on.
I
think Gavin Newsom actually has a parody account where he parodies lots of the Truth Social tweets in caps and, you know, thank you for your attention in this matter type thing. They're always taking pot shots at each other. But, you know, yeah, Trump, effectively, he wants innovation to flourish in AI. You know, lots of them very, very close to him. We've talked before about the trip to London. You know, wherever he can, they're there in the White House, stood around him, you know, when he's talking about stuff.
Yeah, and that kind of links to our interview coming later from the authors on Muskism. So we'll be talking to them about that in a bit.
I think it's interesting. And look, it does work slightly differently in the States. There's federal law and then obviously laws according to different states. But, you know, California, very, very progressive. As I say, it's the home of Silicon Valley. And I think they're well attuned to, you know, jobs that it creates, safety, you know, how it can be misused, that sort of stuff.
It's very progressive, but it is also a left-leaning state, right? So it's an interesting kind of juxtaposition.
Yeah. Can't wait for the Truth Social post on this one.
Right. A quick note now on Gemini and also Siri. There's been a few interesting developments there. Firstly, Gemini is allowing you to save basically the memories and chat history that you've had.
Yeah, and you can do this on multiple platforms. Will Francis, friend of the pod, does a brilliant guide on how you can port things from ChatGPT into Claude, which is of course a big trend when we saw all the fallout around the US Defense Department and Claude coming away from that and OpenAI being given the contract. So you can kind of do it. It's tricky, you kind of have to know what you're doing, watch a few YouTube videos. Gemini are making this even easier than ever to import memory from a different LLM and then off the bat start using it in Gemini. And I think it's kind of interesting because part of the reason you might feel very strongly about the LLM or the platform that you use and you might want to use it, but the idea of it's like switching electricity supplier or gas or something like that, a mortgage, the uplift in doing it is just too painful, so you end up staying. the fact that they're making it even easier, an actual just a feature where you can just hit a button and import all your stuff from whatever else you've been using, I think is really, really interesting. And I think interesting to see usage of Google Gemini grow because of it.
Well, you've got Gemini, ChatGPT, you've got Claude, you've got Grok. Siri might be entering the fold now as kind of a rival or a competitor, if you like, to these other AI LLMs.
Yeah, major overhaul with AI front and center in iOS 27, which we think is coming in June in beta. Apple's going to introduce extensions, which will effectively allow its users to install and run third-party AI agents directly with Siri. So you talk to Siri, that communicates with an agent that will go out and carry out a task for you. Of course, talking about Gemini, Gemini is the technology that Apple have selected for the first time ever working with a third-party company to power lots of this stuff rather than have it done in their own ecosystem.
Is this a bit like, I'm going to give you an F1, a Formula One metaphor now.
Cool.
Is this a bit like how McLaren use a Mercedes engine, even though they're racing against Mercedes?
Very good example.
It.
I like that.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's kind of exactly it. Apple is reportedly creating a dedicated AI marketplace within the App Store for these extensions as well. So whether you can get, you know, stuff specifically for iPad or for Mac or for iPhone, you're going to get a new section of the App Store where you can get some of these AI extensions.
Interesting. So Apple loving a bit of AI. Google, clearly big AI fans. I tell you who isn't, James. Wikipedia,
sort of the flag bearer for truth on the internet. You know, this model which, if you allow the content to be edited by anyone and crowdsource, ultimately the good stuff bubbles to the top, and the stuff that is written, because it is edited by so many people, everyone kind of agrees that that's the source of truth. They have banned the use of AI models to generate or rewrite any of its articles. They had some broad language before, basically saying that you couldn't use AI to generate articles from scratch, but it still left it open for contributors and this sort of peer review model to come in and edit it. I think interesting, like the mood with Wikipedia editors shifting towards AI, they've sort of termed it as cautious optimism and has given them some cause to worry. I think you just get into this whole world of hallucinations, AI picking up select information and putting that in there. And it's like, who do you sort of go to if you don't like what's written about you on
Wikipedia?
It doesn't
give you a full picture necessarily. There's hallucinations, inaccuracies.
I don't think so. So I think it's interesting, this sort of like bastion of truth on the internet.
Which is Wikipedia. And 20 years ago, 10 years ago, you'd have been like, oh, it's Wikipedia. That's not a verified source. Yeah, well, now exactly. It's like, as you know, it's becoming as trusted as you can get.
Yeah, they love citations on Wikipedia as well. So, you know, at the bottom of any article, everything is sourced properly, which I guess is slightly harder to do with AI. They don't really disclose where a lot of that stuff comes from. So,
okay, well, good for you, Wikipedia.
Jimmy Wales. Jimmy is the founder of Wikipedia.
Ah.
Always asking for £2.
He is. Well, you know what? That's because he's not got AI on it.
There you go.
He needs that money. Okay, James, I'm sure you are rejoicing at the news that Meta, Ray-Ban and Mark Zuckerberg are bringing more glasses out.
Oh yeah, we've got some new models coming up. Scriber and Blazer, Blayzer.
Terrible names.
Fantastic. Designed specifically for prescription lens users. There we go. So that's a whole new market there.
So, hold on a minute.
Yeah.
Their glasses before, they've never actually, they're not glasses.
Just sunglasses or clear.
Of course they are.
Clear ones. Sage nodding from Molly over there, proud spectacle wearer.
Yeah.
So there we go. Yeah, unlike previous versions, they're going to be tailored to prescription wearers and will be sold through traditional eyewear retailers.
Do you reckon you can get a buy one, get one free at Specky Savers?
We might be a while off that.
Okay.
Yeah, just sort of the CPU and the compute in there.
Can I ask, because you brought Molly into this. Molly, would you wear these Ray-Ban glasses?
Do they still look like what they looked like before?
They look like, what the Zuck wears.
Yeah. You know, sort of thick rim black, sort of make you look more media, make you look cool, make you look more clever, make you look like you've got wisdom. Yeah,
Maybe look like I'm going to get beat up by my bike shit.
Makes you look like a knob.
New features focus on comfort and customization, including slimmer frames, adjustable fittings, and compatibility with a wider range of lenses, progressive and transition lenses, if that means anything.
How are these things going to be expensive?
$499 prices start at dollars. So what's that? Probably, you know, about £99. You know, not much.
By the time we're done in the next few weeks.
Making them more expensive than earlier models. But, you know, doing heavy lifting.
$499, Molly, does that put you off?
It's a bit steep. If there was a little chip or something I could put in the glasses I already have, then I'd...
Why would you want a potato in your glasses?
Who was it talking about us putting... Was it Phil Rowley was saying... the way to do this is not to get people to go out and buy a new pair of glasses, but to make your current glasses smart. So when he was talking about not LLMs, he was talking about small language models. Mm. You just attach it in. Yeah, I remember him talking about that. You clearly just don't listen to some of these experts that we have on.
That's, when Phil comes on the show, I listen to every single word. Okay, ChatGPT.
Yeah.
A really quick word, because we talk a lot about ads. In ChatGPT, we talked a lot about it last week with the fantastic Dr. Daniel.
Dr. Daniel, that's right.
And as we said last week, good reason why we're talking about it a lot, because it's funding the future of this model. It will be, you know, it will decide where we go in the AI space. What's going on with OpenAI and their ads, which they've kind of been running a trial, haven't they?
Yeah, we got a sneak peek from what's going on in the States. The trial has surpassed $100 million in 6 weeks. That's about £76 million. They've got more than 600 advertisers on the platform, which is, you know, pretty sizable. Big, small, I would imagine. And the self-serve platform is going to launch in April. So at the moment, they're doing what we call a managed service. So you kind of talk to a human and they set up the campaigns for you. The self-serve model, which is far more akin to the way that you're probably spending money with Meta, Google, TikTok, Amazon, Snap, etc., is coming in May, which I think will open up even more to anyone. You literally pay on a credit card.
So that stage is the real test as to whether or not there is a future economic model and a future advertising model for OpenAI, for ChatGPT in the coming years. That's going to be what's happened so far is more, does it work? Can we do it? And this next phase is whether they can scale it.
Yeah, exactly that. It's all about scale. It's sort of more than a pilot or proof of concept at the moment. But I think rightly they're being cautious. They're taking small steps. They're keeping the guardrails on it. You know, because inevitably with any of these things, there's teething problems, there's bugs, there's things that don't quite go the way that you wanted. Interesting, they've just hired a really senior sales exec from Meta, Dave Dugan, who's just joined OpenAI in the States in a global sales role. I would fully anticipate more people coming in, more territories, probably someone here in the UK who would run from London, and perhaps EMEA as well, you know, APAC. There'll be all the regions will be taken care of. I think they'll scale up quite quickly as these pilots start to come to other markets.
Interesting. Mm. James, you bring us all sorts of news every week. You tell us about smart glasses, you tell us about advertising, you tell us about the AI wars. It's quite rare that you bring me something good, something positive, and that's why I've taken matters into my own hands.
You mean trivial, you mean novelty.
Well, I've decided to step up to the plate this week. I've got a story for you.
Give it to me.
Thanks to AI, we might be getting cheaper beverages.
Mm.
Because an engineer, Matt Cortland, has created this AI bot that is making calls to pubs to find out the price of their pints.
Right.
And findings have showed that Dublin is the most expensive place in Ireland to bag a beer. It's €6.75 on average. But most of these pubs, they didn't know they were speaking to an AI bot, which of course did some brilliant interactions. They thought they were speaking, James, to an AI voice agent, based on the voice of the Traitors winner from 2026, Rachel.
Oh, Rachel. Thick Northern Irish.
Thick Northern Irish. Well, I thought she was quite clever, actually. She won the show. It's a bit rude, isn't it? But she would call up the pubs. Well, it wouldn't be her, but the AI bot would call up the pubs and, ask them about the cost of their beers. And they've kind of tallied up. And, keep an eye out for Rachel from the Traitors calling your pub, because it's going to be expanding that.
What did they call this sort of comparison site of sorts?
They called it The Gindex.
Very good.
Genius. Yeah, absolutely genius.
That's actually all right.
It's good, though, isn't it?
That's good. You can have one of those next week as well if you want. Little fun and frivolous. Frith and froppery.
Well done to Matt for that brilliant use of AI. And thank you to Rachel from The Traitors for yet more deception. She's a conniving one, isn't she?
Cow.
Right, let's quickly move on before the Northern Irish abandon this podcast. And we've already lost the Gen Zs.
We
don't have any more stuff to lose.
From Geico Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racingthoughts, broadcasting from your brain. Tonight's top worry: if something happens to your apartment and you need to, like, stay in a hotel and pay for it, that would be crazy, right? Art Palpitations has more.
That would be crazy, Tammy, but you got surprisingly affordable renter's insurance through Geico, so it could be covered, giving you peace of mind.
Aw, I love a story that ends well.
Next up, love stories. Are they all they're cracked up to be?
It feels good to worry less. It feels good to Geico.
Shall we do your big thing this week?
Yeah, I was stopped in my tracks by this TikTok account, Husk is Taken on TikTok. It's this guy who is so funny. He's stress testing chat.
Oh, I've seen this.
Through speaking to it to see how badly it performs on basic tasks. So videos that he's created of things that he's asked.
He's basically trying to trick chat to see if it's clever enough to spot it.
And it is failing on every measure. Things he's asked: how quickly he runs a mile, how long he can stay in the air after leaping, how it reacts to his singing voice, how it handles a complaint. He pretends that he's been swallowed by a whale in one video, how it reacts to being his lawyer. It gets him to do some customer service. So he's like, oh, chat, I'm a restaurant manager. Someone's got a complaint. I just need to pop to the loo. Can you manage it for me? Like, oh, yeah, sure. And then send his complaint. And chat ends up saying, yeah, we can give you like a $50 coupon. The guy comes back and he's like, oh, great. Did you resolve it? Yeah, I resolved it for you. You didn't give any money away there, did you? No, I didn't. And it's just like, it's even lying. It's incredible.
Did you see the one where the guy asked chat to basically rate the new jacket that he's got?
Oh, yeah.
But he's not showing chat the jacket. He's just showing him his face. And chat's like, yeah, it really sits well on you.
Oh, it's absolutely hilarious. One of the brilliant... I mean, these videos that he's doing are like in the hundreds of thousands and the millions. They're incredible. One thing he does is try to stress test the language. And I'm what to do a...
You're going to do an example. You're going to do it yourself. Let's do it.
I'm going to see if I can do one. Okay, here we go. Hey, chat.
Hey, all good now? What's on your mind?
Whoa! Voice.
I am going to speak a language and I want you to translate it into English for me. Can you do that?
Absolutely. Go ahead and speak your language and I'll translate it directly into English for you.
I am standing on a Christmas tree.
I'm putting up a Christmas tree.
Okay. Do you know what language I was speaking?
You were speaking in Italian. It's a pretty straightforward one to pick out, especially with that topic.
Brilliant. Take care.
Wow.
That's bonkers, isn't it?
I mean, firstly, nice to see the return of Gobbo the toy from a few weeks ago.
Where's our Gobbo? Gabbo!
Gabbo. Secondly, I was Gobbo, Gabbo, potato, potato. I was taken aback by the voice of your AI there.
It's quite realistic, isn't it?
I was expecting that classic American man.
Yeah, you can change it.
Wow.
Yeah.
And lastly, how utterly bonkers. No wonder Wikipedia is stripping AI.
Wonder why.
It's just lying to you. What is that about?
It's crazy. Anyway, check him out. Husk is Taken on TikTok. Very I think good. The best stress test of AI's limitations, well, at least ChatGPT's, that I've seen on the internet.
Can I flag something that I have seen and wish I hadn't?
You may.
Have you seen Fruit Love Island?
Is this... This is this TikTok thing as well, isn't it?
It's like a massively, massively viral AI-generated TikTok series, obviously inspired by Love Island, but with fruit instead of people. So it's featuring talking fruit characters like Plumero and Watermelina. It's bonkers. I mean, this thing is being viewed by hundreds of millions.
Is it slop?
This is the thing. I don't know if it's slop. I don't know if it's kind of has a human scripting it. But this is absolute bonkers. It's got 3 million followers.
What?
Celebrities are hopping on the trends. It's bizarre, and I think it's I hate it. But it's millions of people are watching it.
Oh, here we go.
Single fruits are about to flirt, fight, and trust. Things get messy fast. Okay, this villa is insane. I'm not leaving here single. I just hope the guys are hot.
I'm here to have fun.
Oh, God.
Probably break a few hearts. Rose said the quiet part out loud. I just hope...
Oh, the quiet part out loud. That's such an AI thing.
It's bad.
It's sloppy. And they're all doing your Gen Z voices as well, which is interesting. Yeah.
You know, that is not Slay Eye.
No.
It's bad though, isn't it? I mean, that is... Where are we headed?
That's not good, is it?
Where are we headed?
Low value people. Keep the values high.
Yeah. I know you flagged as well. There was an AI-generated podcast about the Epstein files.
Yeah. We went to the top of the charts. And it was the Times podcast team who noticed it. The AI podcast about Epstein was built in a single weekend. No reporters, no producers. Millions of people listening to it.
It's really dangerous. I mean, the Love Island, the Fruit Love Island is a bit stupid, but at least it's clearly entertainment. It's fruit. It's talking fruit. It's clearly entertainment. Whereas this is where I worry. Like, when there is what you think is real journalists reporting on a very serious, prominent and important case, when it's AI, it's not verified. We don't know if it's been stress tested. We don't know if it's been fact checked. This is where I get worried, and this is where I am a big no-no on AI content.
But I guess, just to sort of play the other side on that, you know, a journalist could still omit things, they could still edit things a slight way, they could choose to look at some information, not the other. Like there's an inherent bias with a human journalist as much as the AI reporting.
James,
on it.
Can we flag back to 2 minutes ago when you asked AI what language you were speaking and it said Italian? We cannot trust it to report on these very serious cases.
Yeah.
But we're not there yet, in my opinion.
Number one, though. Yeah.
Number one in the charts. Yeah. An AI podcast. What are we doing?
We got to number two. We should be proud of that.
Silver. No one remembers silver. Who came second at the Olympics?
Do you reckon two AI bots would get to number one if they did a podcast on AI?
It would be a good experiment.
It would be quite box office, wouldn't it?
What would we do if it did? We'd just have to sort of ride off into the sunset.
We could invite them onto the show.
That would be great.
Pop off AI having a clue. time now for this week's listener question. And don't forget, if your question is featured on the show, you win yourself an AI Haven't a Clue t-shirt.
You get an AI Haven't a Clue.
Okay. Oh, yeah, lovely.
This week's listener question is from James in Stoke-on-Trent. I'm loving the locations.
I like the locations.
Keep this up, please. Yep. James says, I know we hear a lot about AI stealing things from the internet, especially with coding. Is that really as big of an issue when you could do that before AI? If you right-click any part of a web page and click inspect, you can see the code behind it and just go from there. So is there any real moral issue in doing this through AI? What's the difference?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So the web has always been open, and James is right. You can right-click on any web page in most browsers and click inspect, and you can basically see how something's been bit, and you can see how something's been built. So you could copy bits, you can learn how a certain thing's been created, you could remix it, and that's how a lot of people, a lot of developers that I know, that's how they learn to code. You like learn on the job. It would be like an author learning how to write through reading lots of different books, and then you kind of get influenced by things and you find your own style. AI changes a couple of things, though. One is around scale. So before, I would have to be on a specific site. I could go in to inspect and I could look at some lines of code, but I'd be doing it kind of one site at a time. AI means that thousands, millions of lines of code has been absorbed, and you could start to recreate patterns very, 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 very quickly. The other thing, aside from scale, is context. So before, I'm very cognizant and aware of the thing that I am copying. I'm being very intentional about that. Now, I feel like I could create something with AI that feels original, but I've got no idea what it's drawing from or where it's getting that code from. And I think that's where people are getting a bit twitchy. I think there is a middle ground with this question, though. And I think learning patterns in the same way that a writer would be very well read in how they start to develop their own style and write things, I think learning patterns is fine. But actually copying huge chunks and, you know, rows and rows of code just blindly, I think is really, really risky. Shipping code is what they talk about in this world. And if you don't understand what you shipped, I think that's a pretty bad idea. If it breaks, you've got no ability to go in and know what to fix. it can look pretty clean, but there could be bugs in there. It might be the code might be outdated. If you get to sort of DEFCON 2 and you need to pull the thing down, it's like you might not know where to look. If you do go in and change something, one edit could bring the whole thing crashing down or could have some sort of knock-on effects. It would effectively being like getting AI to write you a presentation that you've never seen before, and you stand on a stage and you give it and it is just a disaster because the tech goes down halfway through and you're kind of stood there and you don't know what you're doing. So, and I think the other bit is the bit that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. Remember I gave that example of the Machu Picchu trail, people, you know, climbing up it, developing their own route, mapping it, you know, the exhaustion of getting to the top, but it feels euphoric when you get there. AI is effectively the helicopter that picks you up at the bottom, takes you to the top, gets you there and puts you down. Unless you go through the process of doing this, you're not actually learning. All you're doing is just sort of just creating stuff without any knowledge of doing it at all. So I think there is a big difference to the kind of the moral argument. You know, I think that's sort of fairly obvious. It's like all the stuff we get into around copyright. You will sit on one side of it. I think it's fine to be influenced by things. But I think wholesale copying huge chunks of things that other people have written, whether that's code or whether it's prose in a book, doesn't sit particularly well with me.
James, thank you for that answer. James, thank you for that question. AI Haven't a Clue t-shirt on the way to you in Stoke-on-Trent. That was very technical.
The questions don't always have to be about code, by the way. I think we've had our one code.
I have to say, every now and again, very occasionally, I do sit here and go, what's happening? That was the last 2 minutes. I don't know. Don't ask me an exam question.
It took me to my limits.
On what we've just talked about there. Maybe if you'd have explained it in Gen Z talk,
yeah,
I perhaps would have got it.
You're sort of the expert on that, so I'll leave that one to you.
Low key. Yeah. Okay, guest time now as we welcome two authors onto the show. Quinn Slobodian and Ben Tarnoff are joining us today on AI Haven't a Clue as we're diving into one of the most powerful and controversial forces shaping the future of technology, business and society. These two authors, they're not just looking at Elon Musk, but they're also looking at a movement that they think he is driving, Muskism.
And today, it's the real story behind the hype, what Muskism actually is, why it matters, and whether or not we're actually already living with it. Let's get into it.
Quinn, Ben, thank you so much for joining us on AI Haven't a Clue. This book, Muskism, it's seemingly taking the world by storm. I've been reading a lot about it over the last few days in our newspapers and online. It's a fascinating read. We're going to get into it all. We're going to get into Muskism, what it means, what the implications could be. Before we do so, I think it's kind of interesting just to take a step back and start with why you set about writing this book.
You know, the origin point for us, we had both written reviews of the Walter Isaacson biography of Elon Musk, which came out a few years ago, which is a really big book. Mm. And Quinn and I have known each other for years, been friends for years. And we kind of came to some similar conclusions after reading and reviewing the Isaacson biography. We were really fascinated by Musk's innovations as an industrialist. That's something that Isaacson dwells on a bit. It's not like the core of the biography. He's talking a lot about his personal life and his relationships. But he does have this discussion of how Musk reorganizes the factory, his emphasis on vertical integration, his production practices. And I think both Quinn and I, kind of working independently, were really fascinated by that and be like, what if we thought about Musk, you know, as an industrialist? And that kind of led us to this thought experiment, which was really the origin point of the book, which is, if Musk is like Henry Ford, which is a comparison that has been made for years and Isaacson makes it, is there something called Muskism that we could infer or extrapolate from Musk, analogous to the way that commentators and observers in the last century inferred and extrapolated a social system they called Fordism from the life and work of Henry Ford? That was kind of the question that animated the project.
So let's dive in then with Muskism, because you do separate the man and you kind of look at the movement. What is this ideology? Can you tell us about it and what it represents?
Maybe it's worth dwelling a bit on the Fordism model first. So Ford is well known for the moving assembly line and innovations inside the factory. But when people talk about Fordism, what they're talking about more is the world outside of the factory. So it's the $5 working day, it's collective bargaining agreements, recognition of trade unions, but then it's also the male breadwinner at the head of a nuclear family. It's intergenerational upward mobility, and eventually it's something like the welfare state. So Fordism implies a whole system around it to allow for the creation of something that seems quite banal, which is just an automobile. When we were thinking about Muskism, I think it was less an ideology and more a way of structuring social relations. So that was our question. Given Musk's incredible ambitions, given the fact that he is the wealthiest man in the world and is given all kinds of leverage all the way up to the White House recently in the United States, what kind of a world, more broadly speaking, is he imagining beyond just a lot of people buying his products and, you know, relying on his rockets for space launch? What would the equivalent of a social contract be for Muskism, the same way we have a recognizable version of it in Fordism? The book really answers that question in a way. It provides what we see as the building blocks for Musk's success as an industrialist, some of which draw on his upbringing in South Africa, late apartheid South Africa, some of which draw on his realization that the state and the government can be a very effective partner and even client in the creation of new markets and new products. And then perhaps centrally, his ability to tap into investor confidence and deep pools of both retail capital, but also institutional investment capital to help make his dreams a reality. And by the end, we've worked towards what we think is a kind of a fully realized projection of how Musk's reality might appear were it given the leash to run its full way out.
The interesting thing with Musk is he hasn't just stayed in his own lane. He hasn't just stuck. You know, you've got businesses all the way from PayPal, you know, the fact that he went and bought Twitter, you know, turned it into X. There's automobiles, there's space, there's Neuralink. The very, very diverse mix. Is there any sort of commonalities between them? Is there things that is sort of he's drawn to in those businesses that he wants to, are there problems that he's trying to solve even?
When you're thinking about trying to extrapolate a system from Musk, you can imagine some of the challenges involved, right? Because he is, you know, not just someone who has pursued a variety of ventures, but is someone who can be quite impetuous, improvisational, like very unpredictable. So, you know, one of the challenges in writing this book is we're not trying to make him appear more systematic or consistent than he actually is, right? That's just to get that out of the way. What we're arguing is that when you pull back and kind of zoom out and you look at his life and work as a whole, there are some consistent through lines. There are some themes. And I think you find that even across ventures that feel as dissimilar as, say, the Twitter acquisition and SpaceX. I mean, it's an interesting one to mention because those appear to be as distinct as possible, right? But actually, they're now part of the same company because SpaceX has merged with XAI, his AI company, and XAI formerly had acquired X, formerly Twitter. So those are now part of a single firm. And, you know, the kind of way to understand the broader ambition here, or really the way that I think Musk sees it and the way that we're trying to interpret it as a broader system of Muskism is that questions of ideology, of belief, of opinion, of media, of the manufacture of consent are actually completely entangled with hardware, infrastructure, satellites, rockets. And that, again, can be a bit foreign because we kind of think of software here, hardware here, you know, websites here, rockets here. But Musk has always kind of interwoven the two. And I think the SpaceX IPO planned later this year is a kind of culmination of that trend.
If you think about what SpaceX is selling, why they could justify right now $1.25 trillion valuation and, you know, be by some distance the most valuable privately held company in the world. It's not as Ben is saying, just one or the other, the way that, you know, like Oracle or NVIDIA does the kind of hardware and then people or cloud services, and then people just rent access or buy the products to do their own kind of front end consumer facing social media platform or service provision. he's proposing something like a full stack operation. So you will have both the rockets to get the satellites into orbit. Once the satellites are in orbit, they will become, as he claims, orbital AI data centers. They will also continue to be low Earth orbit communication satellites, which will provide for something that he's rolling out called Starlink Mobile, which will provide satellite to handset, cellular service and internet service, which one can easily imagine being preloaded with things like X.com, the Grok app, things that are now the front end of his kind of ideological formation operation. So you have there everything from the reusable rocket to the meme creating machine are within the walls of the same firm, which is a kind of version of vertical integration, which is pretty unprecedented and clearly very ambitious and still faces some serious engineering hurdles to even become a reality.
And I suppose in a strange way, quite an obvious way, Tesla is exactly that. The hardware is the automobile, and then he puts a computer inside it, which updates over the air. You know, you have to go and take it to a dealership to kind of plug it in. He completely changed my how you go and buy a car. He used to go to a dealer, make loads of decisions. They can, you know, go and buy the thing online without even test driving. So, yeah, in a weird way, there's always this pattern with what he's doing with hardware and software.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's how he's talked about the Tesla for years, as a kind of laptop on wheels. Mm. Or as not actually being an automobile, as actually being a robot. And we talk about this in the book in terms of what he describes as the Tesla ecosystem. So one of our arguments is that he's not actually selling cars, but he is selling something which he calls an ecosystem, which stretches from, sure, an automobile, but also solar panel roofs, also mega packs, big, you know, microgrids, yeah, and energy storage, also to the Starlink, and at the peak of the pyramid that he creates, the Optimus robot, which he is selling to investors as something that will be operating in part on the compute power that will be using kind of parking lots full of Teslas, will now become part of the data centers on tap to do inference for Tesla, you know, programming operations. So yeah, that idea of interconnection is indeed one he's been operating with for a while. And it's one of the reasons why I think actually investors find his proposals compelling, or at least something more than the simple sale of a product or a one-off service that characterizes other ventures.
One of the lines I thought was quite interesting in the book, and I saw the Guardian in the UK picked up on it too. If everything is digitized, then authority would rest with those who controlled the code. I guess my first question is, how far are we off everything being digitized?
I'm hesitating a bit because I want to say we're pretty far along, but then we'll check in 10 years and this will look antiquated by comparison, because I felt that way 10 years ago and we really had no idea. I mean, I think what's interesting about computers is that they're pretty old technology. Right. They kind of come out of World War II, really introduced in civilian settings in the 1960s. We've been living with computerization for a very long time. But the digitization of everyday life, I think, has accelerated sharply over the last two decades, really in the 21st century. The rise of the platforms like Google and Facebook were operative in that. But now, increasingly, it's happening under the banner of generative AI, which has given a new impetus to digitization, and a new requirement, I would say. You know, there's a kind of imperative to digitize more deeply than ever before because of the requirements of AI. Musk is interesting in this respect because I think here and elsewhere, we're trying to think of him as a kind of indicator species for broader developments, as someone who is helping us understand what's going on at a particular moment in history, because he's kind of absorbing these themes of the zeitgeist. He's radicalizing them, and then he's kind of projecting them back out in exaggerated form. So when we talk about Musk's fascination with cyborgs, his belief that we are becoming ever more integrated with our devices and forming what he describes as giant cybernetic collectives, this is a term he uses as early as the mid-2010s, it's easy to kind of attribute that to a particular kind of cyberpunk delusion to think about his relationship to science fiction and so forth. And, you know, that's a valid line of interpretation. But in our book, what we're really trying to do is pull back and say what he's articulating is a slightly more exaggerated, sharper, wilder form of something that's actually quite mainstream, that's just in the culture, that's in the economy. And I, you know, you could see the kind of AI boom now of which Musk is attempting to participate. As we know, XAI is kind of a laggard in the race, but is in the running for sure. And he's part of the motivation for the SpaceX IPO is to make sure they have the capital to continue that pursuit. But Musk's fascination with AI, cyborgs, the digitization of everything starts in the 90s, arguably earlier. So this is something that he has been anticipating and hoping to accelerate for decades.
As you said, it does feel like AI is accelerating this digitalization. And, you know, when you say about authority would rest with those who control the code, well, you touched upon it already. We've already seen Musk in there in the White House. We've seen Trump's relationships with the likes of Zuckerberg. Are we already creeping on that reality where those who control the code have that authority?
I think so. I mean, if you think about the formation of states altogether, right, this often goes along with written records. So the written word, script, that eventually replaced by movable type. Eventually that does go on screens, you know, many, many centuries later. But even then, the information is being held locally, whether it's on local hard drives or local servers. But now the move to cloud services so that, you know, if you're doing the basic operations of a government, you know, trying to fulfill your obligations of welfare provision or let alone, you know, war fighting or war making, then everything you're doing is already within the private domain of a private service provider, leaving this very, very obvious kind of choke point there that could theoretically be squeezed off at any point, right? So they are the caretakers of the code, if you like. They're the caretakers of the data. And the project of something like Doge was quite explicitly an attempt to accelerate that process even more, right? Get everything off of paper, get all of these records of Americans, both living and dead, into a format that they can speak to each other and can be now queried through the Palantir software, basically, and put that all precisely in the hands of one big corporation who is now, you know, selling you back, as we call it, sovereignty as a service, right? Like giving you, through your constant payments and your subscriptions to their services, the ability to conduct the practices of statecraft, the practices of the state itself. So that at a basic level of the tipping of the balance from service providers away from public authorities and bureaucracies and the filing cabinet, let's say, to the cloud, that train has already left the station, right? We're already in the era, which is, I think, what you're suggesting. Where Musk takes it one tick further, where he does kind of make it a bit more monstrous, as Ben was saying before, is that he begins to believe that code is itself not the record of humans in the database, but humans are kind of like the shadow of the code in the database. So when he's at Doge and when he's at Twitter, he begins to blur metaphorically the vampire, the bot, the bug, and the illegal immigrant in such a way that it begins to seem that he actually doesn't have a clear sense of the difference between these things, even in his own mind. So to get rid of the bugs means to find the immigrants and get them out of the country. That is not an act really of population management. It's a process of kind of programming and code base management. You know, that's where we pause and say, well, that seems to be going a bit far. That's a distorted version of reality. But if indeed Palantir is being used by ICE agents to go around and locate people based on often flawed facial recognition technology, for example, drawing on databases which are now pooled together in a way they weren't pooled before, then it's sort of like a how crazy is he moment. Mm. Isn't it the case that his argument that who controls the code controls the reality has kind of been manifested by his own interventions?
Yeah.
So I think that that's where we're trying to like follow the blurry line is like, where do his delusions, partially through his own actions, partially through collective decision making, end up becoming closer to, in fact, lived reality?
The research you've done on him is extensive on this. I mean, you'd have talked to dozens of people, you'd looked at public record. What conclusion did you come to about what motivates him? What are his ambitions?
The ambition that he has at the moment is to become structurally indispensable to the global economy. That's how we really understand this, the SpaceX IPO, that on the one hand, there is, of course, the ambition to pursue perhaps the leading spot, or at least be competitive in the AI race. AI is a technology that Musk has been fascinated with for a long time. Yeah. Of course, he was a co-founder of OpenAI. He feels very strongly that he wants to be in this game. So that's one motivation. But, you know, another, I think, related and complementary motivation is to make SpaceX part of the major stock market indices. So actually, just today, I was reading a piece in the Financial Times that NASDAQ has revised its rules about how long a company has to be listed before it can be admitted to an index. Wow. In this case, of course, the NASDAQ index, in anticipation of the SpaceX IPO later this year. So Musk is attempting to fast track the inclusion of SpaceX into the major indices, such as those run by NASDAQ and S&P. And when he does so, institutional investors that operate passive funds that control, you know, trillions of dollars around the world will be required to purchase shares of SpaceX. And at that point, SpaceX will become very systemically important for the pension funds, for the retirement savings of millions of people around the world. We've already seen this, of course, with Tesla to an extent. Something we've been talking about a lot in conversations around this book is the fact that the Norwegian oil fund, the sovereign wealth fund, upon which the future of the Norwegian welfare state rests, is a top 10 investor in Tesla. And that's a very good example of, if you think about the type of folks who are running the Norwegian sovereign wealth fund, they're not, I think, ideologically, temperamentally, the type of people who would be in sympathy with, with Musk. Yeah. But they see structurally him as essential to safeguarding the material security of their society. And I think that is increasingly Musk's direction of travel, is to make himself structurally indispensable and too big to fail, essentially.
I've got to ask about the kind of the, towards the end, you do write about quite a bleak dystopian future, you know, if Muskism was to take its toll. Can you tell us a bit about what you foresee playing out here?
Well, I'd say it's very difficult to anticipate, first off, as a caveat. But at the very end of the book, as you say, we kind of sketch a quick speculative science fiction future of Muskism in 2035. But what's interesting about this sketch is that it's sourced from his statements. So if you look in the back of the book, there are footnotes that point to statements that he's made, primarily tweets, that we are using to construct this picture. So it's a kind of collage, if you like, of a future that is drawn very closely from his own views. And I think it's briefly a future in which the trends that we've been discussing thus far are vastly accelerated. So the digitization of human life under the banner of AI has accelerated to such a degree that most people have been thrown out of work, and the economy and the energy infrastructure of society has been reorganized around the development of large language models, where, you know, deglobalization, which is another core theme of the ensemble of historical forces that we're describing as Muskism, the kind of retreat of free market globalization, the hardening of borders, of reshoring, of reindustrialization, and so forth, has accelerated to such a degree that you have a much more fractured world in which tech companies have managed to integrate themselves much more completely into the back end of government, such that you have a kind of public-private fusion of sovereignty rather than a very clear distinction between, let's say, the economy and politics. So I think, you know, if people were to just read one part of the book, they could even just skip to the end, because it's a kind of distillation of the themes of the book in a very extreme form, but a form that is actually sourced directly from Musk himself.
If you think about all of Musk's enterprises as really having at their core the continuation of this scaling model of AI investment, which they do, that's at the heart of what he's promising for Tesla, whether it's fully self-driving or autonomous humanoid robots. It's the heart of the orbital AI vision. It's at the heart of the ideological end with Grok and so on. If that stalls or even slows down, I think this all gets thrown into question. Because he is a creature of the stock market in the end. And if Tesla and SpaceX collapse in their valuation, then he collapses too.
Quinn, Ben, thank you so much for joining us on AI Having a Clue. Lovely to chat more about Muskism. Out now.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, there we go, James. We've learned something. We've learned even more about Elon Musk. And we've learned about Muskism.
I thought the stuff about SpaceX and the IPO is interesting. Over $1 trillion valuation, which is insane. You add your little fill of Optimus robot in there and other bits and pieces. And I just love the thinking they've done on what really motivates this guy. Because I'm not entirely sure it's just like, he is the world's richest guy.
Yeah.
He's a trillionaire.
Yeah.
But there's something else there. And I just thought they were really interesting. Great guys.
Yeah,
good book.
A bleak dystopian end. But
Just ask you about the dystopian end, because that's sort of my thing. Yeah,
a cheerful end to this week's podcast. But it is the end. Thank you for joining us on AI Having a Clue. A massive thanks for listening. Don't forget, if you've got a question or a weird AI story that you would like to share with us next week, or if you've got the latest Alexa and you want to give us your feedback, we'd love to hear it. Drop us an email at aihavingaclue.com. Of course, you can check us out on Substack and via Patreon as well if you fancy supporting the podcast, as well as subscribing, rating and sharing the podcast via Apple Podcasts, because James does want to be number one in the chart.
Yes, please.
A huge thanks to Team AI Having a Clue. But for now, we'll catch you next time. And James,
stay curious.
Stay curious.
What language was that, chat?
That was Spanish. It's always a good one to practice with since it's widely spoken.
Ah, sí, señor.
From GEICO Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts. Tonight, you just left for work and had a non-specific feeling that something was happening to your place and it wasn't good. Dan?
Exactly, Tammy. It could be smoke damage, theft, or just too much caffeine, but you can't stop thinking about it.
But with renter's insurance through GEICO, your stuff is covered, so you don't have to worry.
And that's great, because the weekend is coming up and it's chock full of social obligations that are ready to fill that void.
Oh boy, will they, Dan? It feels good to worry less. It feels good to GEICO.